The second case on today's oral argument calendar is number A18-2079, Gordon versus Consulting Radiologists Limited and others. It appears counsel are ready. Counsel for appellant, Mr. Merkinich, you may approach and begin. Please state your name at the beginning, and you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. My name is Marco Merkinich, and may it please the court, counsel, I am here today on behalf of three defendants and appellants, Consulting Radiologists Limited, which is a radiology practice based in the Twin Cities, and two of its members, practicing physicians, board members, and officers of the board, Dr. Norman Arslandler and Dr. Christopher Tillotson. We are here today because the trial court erred in entering judgment for Dr. Jeffrey Gordon, a fellow radiologist, shareholder, and board member at CRL. The claim was based on alleged breaches of a fiduciary duty, supposedly in Dr. Gordon's status as a shareholder, and alleged violations of the Minnesota Business Corporation Act. The trial court confused employment and shareholder issues and failed to properly consider the importance of two written agreements in defining the relationship between the parties and proceeding along the path it did. The trial court also rejected and failed to consider the impact of the jury's finding rejecting all of the challenges to the termination of Dr. Gordon and basically determining that the termination was itself lawful. Dr. Gordon's relationship with CRL was governed by
determinations were on issues for which the jury did not have exclusive final authority to make. Is that right?
No, the jury did have final exclusive authority to make.
Just referencing?
Yes.
And which counts were those?
It was the whistleblower count, the marital status discrimination count, and the hostile environment constructive discharge count, which was a little bit more mixed, but ultimately came down on the side where the jury was making an actual finding, sitting as a finder of fact and applier of the law. Which is one of the problems, by the way, in the way the trial court handled factual issues, because the trial court failed to properly defer to findings made by the jury, incidental to its determinations on those issues that were submitted to it for actual decision.
Which, the ones that were submitted to the jury for actual and final decision, which ones of those are you objecting to?
We are not objecting to the jury's finding on those submitted to it for actual
decision.
You're arguing
that the judge should have followed those.
The judge needed to follow those, both as to what they found and also as to the facts that were necessary to those findings. And the judge failed in both regards.
And you've identified those in your brief.
We have identified throughout the brief the areas where the judge's findings departed from what the jury decided. For example, the jury rejected the claims of marital status discrimination. The jury rejected the claims that that Dr. Gordon was a whistleblower who was terminated.
But the trial court didn't take a different position on the marital status.
No, but the way the judge handled then those arguments made in connection with the fiduciary duty and business corporation code claims failed to consider and give appropriate weight to the jury's findings on those issues. So with the jury having rejected the idea that the termination was motivated by and part of a marital status discrimination claim, the judge ignored that when he determined whether certain actions along the way were influenced by conversations, for example, with Dr. Gordon's wife.
These are all independent theories. I mean, why are the jury's resolution and the district court's resolution necessarily inconsistent?
Well, first of all, they're inconsistent because of the way the trial court acted and what the trial court did to ignore the actual agreements that existed and giving no weight really to them. I can give an example of that, but first there were two agreements, right? The written agreement that defined employment. It created both an employment at will. It also said within the agreement, making it even more clear, that you could be terminated with cause or without cause. And if he were terminated without cause, Dr. Gordon was to receive what turned out to be $140,000 in notice pay as part of the termination process. Dr. Gordon received that pay. There has never been a claim, by the way, that his written employment agreement was violated. Second, on the claim for the shareholder agreement, That was submitted to the jury for decision, and because those claims and the impact of that agreement affected the damage claims on the claims that were submitted to the jury was acting as the decision maker on that count. The jury found that the shareholder agreement was in fact binding on Dr. Gordon and on CRL. And that's important.
But the trial court then went on to make other findings based upon testimony from various people before the court to conclude that there was more than just that written agreement that controlled.
The trial court did do that, and we submit wrongfully that under Minnesota law, the judge was required to respect the written agreement. I would note, too, if you look at the trial court's summary judgment ruling before trial, with respect to the Minnesota Business Corporation Code claim, the trial court summary judgment ruling said, the reason this case is going to trial is because it's possible that the shareholder agreement is not binding on Dr. Gordon. That's the fact issue that is going to be decided at trial.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding. So I think you're talking about count 9, which is the unjust enrichment count, where the jury question was, is the plaintiff bound by the stock repurchase agreement? In other words, was a contract form? Is that what you're talking about?
We're talking about question 1 on the jury verdict form, which is not solely limited, in our view, to question 9 or count 9. It's an element of damages in every claim that was made, because the claimant, Dr. Gordon, said that my damages for all of the counts that were asserted include a buyout value based at fair market value. So it wasn't limited to an unjust enrichment count.
So they also were asked about whether or not there is a breach of duty by the two individual defendants and responded affirmatively to that and put a value of the breach.
And that was
advisory, right?
That was advisory.
Yeah.
And on the Business Corporation Code Act, that was advisory.
And
they found that they
won on that one.
We did win on that one.
Yeah.
The point I'm trying to make here is that before trial, the judge issued a summary judgment ruling that said the reason this is going to go to trial on the Business Corporation Code claim is to determine whether the shareholder agreement is binding on Dr. Gordon and the company, because Dr. Gordon was saying, I didn't receive it and all sorts of other things. And the jury found that, in fact, the agreement was binding on Dr. Gordon. The trial court agreed with that finding by the jury, so it doesn't really matter whether the jury was advisory or non-advisory because they both were in agreement. But instead then of dismissing the Minnesota Business Corporation Code claims, which is what his summary judgment ruling said would be the consequence of that finding, the judge went ahead to reverse the advisory jury finding on that count and find that there was a violation. And that's important because that's the only claim in this matter on which there's a finding that justifies an attorney fee award. So that Business Corporation Code not only ignores the plain language of the statute that suggests and I think requires that the court defer to the written agreements of the parties when there are two clear written agreements here, that should have happened. And the jury decided what the one agreement meant.
Is liability on the 751 claim sufficient for an award of attorney fees under 467?
On the 751 claim would, I think, be sufficient to justify attorney's fees, but only if the court also finds that that it's an equitable remedy appropriate for that.
So the award of, in your view, the award of attorney fees under 467 requires equitable relief. Or equitable relief is a prerequisite for attorney fees.
Exactly. And what we submit
here. Is there case law on that point?
Pardon?
Is there case law on that point?
I think we cited the case law that said, it comes at the reverse, from the reverse angle, Your Honor. What it says is that there is not a standalone claim for violating 467. So you only get to 467 if you have a substantive violation of another part of the Minnesota Business Corporation Act, and therefore it comes around in circles that way.
In your view, a violation of another section and equitable relief for that violation.
Right. And one of our key points here is that there's a complete disconnect between the claim for relief and the theories of liability. And that is both a relief issue, a remedy issue, and it's a substantive violation issue. because Dr. Gordon's claims, both the fiduciary duty claims and the business corporation code claims, are premised on his status as a shareholder. As a shareholder, the jury found conclusively that he was entitled to $10,000, which he received. There's no dispute about that. So there's no damage. Well, this court recently, in the Roberts case, went through and explored, well, when do you get employment loss damages incidental to a fiduciary duty claim and presumably a business corporation claim? And the court said, you get that when there's a reasonable expectation of long-term or permanent employment. And you tell that by looking at the agreements.
Well,
and here we have agreements that are very clear in saying that you have, you're an employee at will, that not only are you an employee at will, but that you can be terminated without cause, and you get notice and you get paid for that notice period. So there was no reasonable expectation, and as this court has also said, mere general statements of job security do not overcome written agreements. So the trial court did not apply that law and did not properly consider that law in issuing its findings.
The court looked at testimony from two doctors who expected to be there, not forever, but long term.
But, Your Honor,
that's what the trial court grabbed onto.
Right, Your Honor, and this court has specifically said those kinds of statements, and this was both in Gunderson and I'm forgetting the second case that reaffirmed it, but it's in our brief.
Berriman?
Yes, and basically said directly that general statements of job security and job expectation don't overcome written agreements. Here there's a clear written agreement. There's not even been a claim that it was violated, and all the other theories that challenged the termination were rejected by the jury. But yet
these statements, however, were not just statements by anybody. These statements were made by what was it, the chair of the board?
They were said by fellow doctors and board members, and they were statements of expectation. Yes, I'd like to be here, and yes, they were general statements of job security and job expectation, but they don't overcome written agreements, and that's what this court has consistently held in dealing with fiduciary duty and business code claims.
Isn't it true that written agreements between the parties may inform the analysis under 751, but it's not, it doesn't limit the person's rights under 751? There could be unfairly prejudicial conduct that is unfair for reasons beyond the agreement, right?
Well, the statutory language says that is not absolutely mandatory, but it comes very close. It says, for purposes of this section, any written agreements, including employment agreements and buy-sell agreements between or among shareholders, between or among one or more shareholders and the corporation, are presumed to reflect the party's reasonable expectations.
But it doesn't say that those expectations are exclusive, or that's the extent of their rights under 751.
But the advisory jury did deal with that question, and the advisory jury flatly found that Dr. Gordon had not proved, by the greater weight of the evidence, that any of the defendants engaged in fraudulent, illegal, or unfairly prejudicial conduct toward Dr. Gordon. So the advisory jury understood the situation, and the trial court judge never really explained why otherwise, given the written agreements between the parties. And it's those written agreements that both inform whether there is a breach of duty, whether there is a duty, and then, more importantly, whether there's any damage associated with it. Because what happened as a result of the way the trial court applied these different principles is that a shareholder investment of $10,000, for which Dr. Gordon was repaid $10,000, resulted in $640,000 in liability. And you can't do that based on a status as a shareholder. Dr. Gordon had an investment at a certain dollar value. He received it back. There was no harm to him under the Business Corporation Code or under his employment agreement. And secondly, then, how do you get lost employment wages? We've pointed out that the trial court never explains how it calculated its numbers. It simply said, well, the advisory jury did this, so I guess I'll do it.
Well, the district court's calculation was greater than what the jury said, right?
Yes. And it's, and there's,
I mean,
no,
I think the district court did explain its math in arriving at the figure of 900,000 sum, but simply decided to limit it to something the advisory jury had said was more reasonable.
Well, the overall number you just cited, Your Honor, was a combination of what the advisory jury did, attorney's fees, and prejudgment interest.
I'm sorry if I so misstated
the number. So what the trial court said in its findings and its
I thought he lost like $192,000 per year for 5 years, but...
That's what he said, but he said that's just the number
But isn't that what the district court found, too?
No, he didn't issue any findings. What he said is this is the number the jury gave, and there are reasons I can articulate it could even have been higher, so therefore I will accept it, is in essence what he did.
Well, that's in essence a finding of the trial court, is it not?
Your Honor, with all respect, I don't think so. I think what a finding requires is setting forth a basis that says, here is what the claim is, here is how it's calculated, here's what it's based on. Also, we note that the trial court refused to allow our expert to testify in damages issues and issued very confusing jury instructions on damages. It would be unrealistic to expect a law student, much less a lay jury, to be able to sort through the different damages calculations that apply to fiduciary duty claims and employment claims of the kind the jury found no liability.
Oh, yeah. Judge Riley has a question.
So I just want a clarification in your brief, and it's on page 54 into page 55, and that's about the September letter that respondent sent with his list of complaints.
Yes.
And you said, additionally, the board did all the investigation into Gordon's September 29, six-page complaint. And then you said, and this is what, I was puzzled by this, the board members experienced many of the allegations in the document. Well, could you clarify what you meant by that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. These, Dr. Gordon's submission 6 weeks after all these events happened, after he had noticed that the board was going to discuss physician conduct at this meeting, he faxed in this letter. And the allegations are basically a recap of everything that had happened over the prior 6 weeks. So there was the board had no reason to conduct a new and intensive investigation because these were facts and events they'd lived through. And there was no reason to do that. And that was an argument made to the jury, and the jury rejected the whistleblower claim that was premised on this letter.
You can see where a person might read that sentence saying the board members also were victims, similar victims to the allegations in the document.
I do see that, Your Honor, and I think a better way to say it is the board members lived through the events described in the letter, had their own perspectives.
They had firsthand knowledge.
They had firsthand knowledge of everything in the letter that needed to be addressed and saw no need to do it. That, by the way, goes to the whistleblower claim, and it doesn't go... And by the way, again, this was an action by the board, not by Dr. Tillotson and Dr. Arslanler. They were the only two defendants on the fiduciary duty claim. The corporation was on the business corporation code claim too, but not on the fiduciary duty claim. And that was also overlooked by the court.
Thank you, Mr. Merkinich. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, Randy Gullickson with my colleague Dan Hall representing Dr. Jeff Gordon. I will confess it was a little bit of a challenge when I thought about how to present this to you today, because usually I don't have cases where the appeal is so broad. In this case, the trial court judge, according to the appellants, got many factual findings incorrect, failed to make findings that the court should have made, got virtually every legal issue wrong, and they even have a quarrel with the jury instruction on a claim in which they won. So what I want to try to do is frame what I think are the two overarching issues on which this case can and should be decided. The first is the legal framework that applies when claims are made by a shareholder, employee, director under the fiduciary duty doctrine and the 751 doctrine. Because they've got it wrong. They have an oversimplistic approach that says the contract is the end of the analysis when the law says the contract is a presumption, and the court found continuing the analysis led to the conclusion that Gordon's reasonable expectations were violated. Second issue is the proper standard of review. Now, I know you know the proper standard of review, but the way it was applied by appellants in this case is wrong in a couple of important respects, so I want to be able to touch on that today. So first of all, the law of reasonable expectations. Plaintiffs have said in every brief they've written in this case, this is an employment case. It's not an employment case. It's not an employee case. It's a shareholder director employee case. That's different than the law that applies to someone who's just an employee. Before we get to the trees, though, I want to make sure we see the forest. Shareholders in a closed corporation like this are fiduciaries. Co-directors are fiduciaries. That is the highest standard, the highest duty one can have under the law, the same as partners in a partnership, the same as trustees to beneficiaries. This court has described it as the highest standard of integrity and good faith in their dealings. Contrary to the appellant's argument, there is not a requirement for egregiousness. Now, it is true in some cases there's egregious conduct, but that is not the requirement. If you only had to avoid egregious conduct, it wouldn't be much of a standard, let alone the highest standard. And here there was egregious conduct. We have a 100 and some paragraph set of findings that describes a course of conduct here where the appellants, one of them had a months-long secret series of communications with my client's wife. He found out. That led to a series of unfair, dishonest actions that ultimately led to his termination. So this was egregious. And then finally, keep in mind, fiduciary duty has two components. Substantive obligations that focus on the outcome. You got to look at that. And procedural obligations that focus on the process. The outcome has to be fair. The process has to be fair. That's the law with partners in these kinds of closed corporations. Now,
Mr. Gullickson, could I ask you, and I'm sure you have more prepared, but I'd like to ask about, I'm wondering, the district court made findings that there were breaches of various types. I'm unclear for some of those breaches whether there's any nexus at all between the breach and the damages that were sustained or were awarded. Can you break that down for me, or can you identify the breaches of fiduciary duties that most animate the findings of damages?
Right. What the court said, it was a course of conduct that led to the termination, and that's why the damage award is based upon lost wages. That course of conduct included Dr. Arslander's secret communications with Dr. Gordon's wife over a period of time, asked her to keep it secret. This is Dr. Gordon's mentor. He knows he can have an effect on his life. And he is telling his wife secretly, asking about people that work for Dr. Gordon, how they should be dealt with, personnel matters, business matters. Okay, that's number one. Dr. Gordon then found out about it. The next day he was accused of having breached some confidentiality. They call a secret board meeting without telling him, take him off the board. Figure out they did that wrong, then they put him back on the board, don't tell him. Multiple conversations where Dr. Gordon is pleading, I want to come and talk to you to work through this.
So I think
I'm simply asking that Dr. Arslander not be there.
I think your answer is that all of these breaches are necessary parts of the causation.
I don't know if they're all necessary. They all feed into the causation that resulted in the terminations.
What if there is, you know, a clear error in a finding of fact with one of those breaches? Then what? What happens to
I don't think that would affect the outcome. There's no single breach that the court said is required for the determination that it caused these damages. I mean, ultimately, the damages were caused when his employment was terminated.
Did he also have damages arising from from the suspension by itself, just the suspension?
Not monetary damages. He was paid during that time period.
Okay. Did the district court award equitable relief?
Yes.
In what form?
Monetary relief. And that's allowed. Fiduciary duty, 751, equitable claims. Okay. Courts have awarded monetary relief in the form of damages. They call it fiduciary duty damages. If you go back and look at Pedro, there was a contract there that said the value you get is X. And the court said, we apply that because 751 says buy-sell agreements are presumed to determine fair value, but we're going to award as breach fiduciary duty damages the difference between that and actual fair value. In other cases, McGrath is one, courts have awarded for breach of fiduciary duty and 751 claims lost compensation. Why?
That's considered equitable in nature?
Yes.
Okay, so you would agree with appellant's theory then that some type of equitable relief is necessary before an award of attorney fees?
No, not at all.
I know you're saying in this case there's no problem, but the appellant's theory, I think, is that in order for an award of attorney fees, there needs to be both a violation of the MBCA and there needs to be equitable relief. And
no.
You would agree with that much?
No. Okay. 751, I think it's fair to say you'd need to prevail on 751, which is an equitable relief statute, to get fees under 751. 467 simply says if there is a violation of the Model Business Corporation Act in a claim brought by a shareholder, the court can award attorney's fees and equitable relief.
And that's,
period.
Does 751 have its own fee shifting
yes.
provision?
Subdivision 7, I believe.
Okay.
Now, here's the important thing that you need to understand about these cases. Courts, when it's a shareholder employee as opposed to an employee, right? If you're an employee, not a shareholder, different set of rules. If you're an employee in a company, and even a shareholder in a company that's not a close corporation, different set of rules. But in a shareholder-employee case involving a close corporation, the courts seek to enforce the reasonable expectations of the shareholders. So the question is, how do you get to that? And you start with what are the claimed reasonable expectations that the shareholder holds? Here, what Dr. Gordon said, I had a reasonable expectation to continue working here as long as I wanted to and as long as I did a good job and there wasn't a reason to terminate me. Okay, that's step one. So then the question is it reasonable? Courts will look at a number of factors. Is it purely subjective? Or on the other hand, is there other objective evidence to show that it's reasonable? Now, agreements are a part, and indeed an important part of that calculation. You look at agreements, because if there's an agreement saying you're at will, that would be an indication that there might not be an expectation to continued employment. But it is a presumption. Now, the definition of a presumption means that presumption can be overcome by other evidence. In the cases that have been cited, there are a number of unreported cases. In all those cases, the court found there was no evidence to overcome that presumption that the at-will contract status define the reasonable expectations. What do we have here? We have what I would submit is the best evidence I've ever seen in a case, and the best evidence, frankly, I can imagine, of evidence to overcome that presumption. What is that? We have the chairman of the board who testified that his role in the company is internal operations and overseeing doctor employment and relationships. That's his job. Okay, what he testified to when he was asked about terminating shareholders, he said, "I think of it like an amputation. It is unreversible. It's serious. It affects people's careers, and because of that, I only do it as a last resort in limited circumstances and with good reason." The district court laid this out in its order and explained that supports the reasonable expectation. Now, they said, well, Judge, you didn't explain it well enough in your first order, so they brought a motion for amended findings and a new trial. And specifically, one of the focuses was this issue. Wait a minute, you got these contracts. And the judge said, it's a presumption, and there's testimony in the record that overcomes that presumption. I'd also point out here that there's been a misstatement about what that employment contract says. He says it says he can be terminated for any reason. It does not say that. He said it says you can be terminated without cause. It does not say that. What it does say is can be terminated A, if there's misconduct. Misconduct is defined. There's no suggestion that they met that standard. And then it says he can be terminated on 90 days' notice. Now, as a matter of contract law, a court would probably interpret that to say they're at will. But that contract says he can be terminated on 90 days' notice. It doesn't say without cause, without reason. It doesn't say with good reason. But in assessing the reasonableness of expectations from that document, you certainly cannot look at that and conclude that you can be terminated without cause for any reason. Now, here there was not good reason. The court went through that. They have a number of excuses about what...
For a moment, wasn't there some communication at the time of termination that it was without cause?
Absolutely. The only evidence that there was this was anything other than without cause came this lawsuit. There's not a document that exists that says any reason for this termination other than is without cause. And that was both in the board action where they terminated him after the 10-minute meeting. They got a 9-page letter asking them to investigate. They had a 10-minute meeting. Most of the doctors said it had already been decided beforehand, but they had a 10-minute meeting, excludes Dr. Arslanlern, and came back and said, we're terminating without cause. The next day, he got a letter saying, you're terminated without cause. So here, they have an absolute duty of candor with him. He was still their partner. That is an admission that it was without cause. It is an admission that it was without good reason, which Dr. Arslanlern said is required. So this is a case where the presumption has been overcome. If for them to win in this case, you would have to overrule the law that says this is a presumption. Because it's a presumption, the court made specific findings under an abuse of discretion standard that there was enough evidence to overcome the presumption.
I want to ask you, I felt whipsawed by the judge's summary judgment finding with regard to Judge Tillotson's letter to Abbott, where he said he was obligated to send it in summary judgment. And then his finding, I'm looking at 139, finding 139, Tillotson breached his fiduciary duties to plaintiff by sending a false letter to Abbott for purpose of causing plaintiff's hospital privileges to be revoked.
Yeah. It's the difference between being able to have people there testifying and judging their credibility and seeing all the evidence versus what you put in an affidavit in a summary judgment motion. That's why you have Rule 54. Rule 54 says findings aren't final and can be changed until a judgment is entered.
You would agree it was a reversal of his finding in the summary judgment?
I would
judgment.
Agree it's a different factual finding.
Okay.
And keep in mind that was not a factual finding in summary judgment. It was that there wasn't a disputed evidence of that at the time. And by the way, counsel talked about the reason for summary judgment in the district court. I can't remember the issue that it had to do with, and that in trial he ruled in our favor on a different aspect. Summary judgment order is not an order that says this is the only factual dispute to be tried. Summary judgment has to decide, is there any factual dispute, which if it ruled in favor of the non-moving party would get you to trial. It doesn't mean other issues in the case are not going to be part of the lawsuit.
So the judge granted summary judgment on defamation, interference with prospective economic advantage. You withdrew your wage claim and the whistleblower claim.
We did not remove the whistleblower claim. That is an error in the opening paragraph of the trial court's order. If you look at the jury verdict that went to the jury, we lost on that.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just make one final comment? I see I'm out of time. I just wanted comment on this discussion, the first few minutes with Mr. Merkinich about the other jury instructions and how that created some inherent argument regarding what the judge did decide. That's the first time I've heard that argument. So I think that's something that was not preserved. It was not argued in the brief. And so I urge you not to make a decision on those grounds. We would urge you to affirm the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gullickson. Mr. Merkinich, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. With respect to the topic just addressed, the law remains the law, which is when a jury decides things, those findings are binding on both the trial court and the appellate court. That's not an argument that's waived. It's part of our standard of review argument that we made.
Well, except judges can grant, and I'm old, so I think we used to call it judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
Right, but that was not done here, and nor was there any appeal made, by the way, of the finding that on the defamation claim. So that is the law of the case, and the judgment is that Dr. Tillotson's communication to Abbott Northwestern was both truthful and required. And that's just the law of the case right now. And there's no basis to change it. With respect, and the trial court judge did not change it either. There are two counts here that are involved, and I want to, in order to affirm this award, this court would have to ignore all of the jurisprudence that exists under these two theories, because it's been really clear that when you have a written agreement and you have a non-family corporation, even if it's closely held, you need to show something to create a reasonable expectation of long-term or permanent employment to recover this kind of damages. And that's critical. That is not present here. And in the comments made by my opposing counsel, it was clear he understands that this is an employment loss damages calculation. And in Roberts, the court looked directly at that and went through the history of jurisprudence in the state and said, you know, Gunderson and so on and so forth, we look at that. And in order to move from shareholder damage to employment loss in one of these kinds of cases, you have to have a reasonable expectation of long-term employment. That's not present here. And it's not present here.
The court found that it was present as a consequence of the testimony of the of at least two doctors, and one of which was the, I call him the manager, but the...
And the trial court was wrong when he did that because he ignored the law of this court and the Supreme Court, which has held that to find that reasonable expectation, in when there is a written agreement, you have to look to the written agreement. And when it's not a family situation, you have to have something more than general statements of job security in order to achieve that outcome. So when you look at it here, here's the situation.
This wasn't a statement of job security given to an employee. The trial court found that this was the standard that the business was going to use, as was articulated by...
That testimony was Dr. Arslanler explaining how he viewed his role in a termination process. It was not a modification of the written agreements between the parties, which made it very clear that there were terminations and you were subject to termination without good cause. Now, the fact that you, when you're challenged in court, and there, remember, there were three counts that alleged wrongful termination theories, the fact you explain the reason for your decision is not inconsistent with choosing to characterize the terminations without cause, nor is it inconsistent with there being a reasonable expectation of employment being subject to termination with 90 days notice pay. This was not a group that decided, for example, to characterize this as for cause, which would have meant no pay. Dr. Gordon received $140,000 for not working because of that decision, which is inconsistent with any intimation of bad faith. So here, there's no loss as a shareholder because the theory they pursued there was that there's a fair market value for an ownership interest in this company and we lost it. And that testimony was allowed in. The jury rejected that and said it's $10,000 only. The jury also rejected all the wrongful termination case theories that were in there. So whistleblower, marital status discrimination, hostile environment, all those claims were rejected by the jury. And by the way, the part of the whistleblower claim that was withdrawn were the claims against the individual doctors, not against the corporation. That was decided by the jury. With respect to the fiduciary duty claim, then, you can't get under existing law to this outcome. Even if you find that there is some sort of duty that's inconsistent with the written agreements, even though there's no family relationship here. And the conduct, by the way, in all those cases is far more egregious than anything alleged in this case, as shown by the fact the jury rejected all of the wrongful termination claims and theories alleged. On the Minnesota Business Corporation Court, that was an advisory jury, but the jury specifically found there was no prejudicial or unfair conduct. The trial court just said, well, I disagree, without really explaining why or how his disagreement is consistent with the jury's findings on those areas and claims where the jury was finding once and for all.
Does the trial court have to give an explanation for a different finding from a jury's finding, which is advisory only?
I believe, Your Honor, that the trial court has a duty to explain its rulings based on Rule 52 and the federal and the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure that require it to issue findings. I believe that it's prudent for the trial court.
You're suggesting that the trial court has to give an explanation for a finding the trial court makes when it differs from an advisory jury's finding.
No, Your Honor, what I was saying is when the jury has made binding findings and the trial court departs from them and their logical inferences, then the trial court does need to explain how, when it's acting, and this goes to the fundamental structure of the case, which was jury claims, non-jury claims. Jury claims come first. Trial court has to accept or, on a JNOV standard, reject the jury findings, but that review is de novo. And the trial court didn't do that. It just simply ignored these findings and made findings to support its rejection of the advisory jury that are inconsistent with what the jury did on those claims where the jury actually made the decision. And we submit that was wrong. So at the end of the day, we believe that in order to sustain this verdict, the court would have to ignore all of the cases that deal with these fiduciary duty, business 751, employment cases, and create new Minnesota jurisprudence that would allow recovery on an employment loss theory when there's no reasonable expectation of permanent employment, because there's a written agreement that says otherwise, standard practices that say otherwise, and there's no family relationship at issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Merkinich. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its written opinion within 90 days.